We are talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to be back.
Yes, welcome back.
Thank you.
And we saved a bunch for you.
So. Yeah.
So starting out with the Seattle City Human Service Providers.
Yeah. Yeah, the city on a regular basis rolls out new contracts for service providers to sign, particularly ones that are providing services to the homeless population, and the city contracts with a number of different groups to do that. This year, the contracts that the city rolled out had a couple of really big changes in them that the city didn't discuss with service providers before. They just stuck them in there. And a number of those service providers are now saying that they don't want to sign contracts with the city of Seattle because of these new big changes. This week, three of those groups that serve specifically the Native American demographic sent a letter to Mayor Durkin, Deputy Mayor Tiffany Washington, who is her housing and homelessness coordinator, and Human Services Interim Director Helen Howell. In that letter, the three groups, which are Chief Seattle Club, the Seattle Indian Health Board, and Mother Nation, which serves Native American women, say that the new requirements will force them to ignore the population that they explicitly formed to serve, which is Native Americans. Now, the changes specify that service providers must go where the city tells them to, typically to encampments that are being targeted for sweeps, and they must offer housing and services to whoever they find in those encampments. They can't just concentrate on the demographic that they've been serving. These groups point out that Native Americans often avoid the large encampments that are highly visible and in places where the city tends to sweep encampments. And Native Americans tend to cluster into smaller groups, and they tend to hide. They don't park on city sidewalks in front of businesses, for example. Now, the service providers are also being required to collect personal information from each person they serve and then report that information on to the city, some of which could be a violation of their client's privacy. For example, the contracts now require service providers to ask whether a person has a substance abuse problem, if they have a mental health diagnosis, whether they're a survivor of sexual assault or physical abuse, if they have a criminal history, what is their immigration status. And these new reporting requirements, not only could they be a violation of their client's privacy, it could also jeopardize the trust that service providers work so hard to try to establish with homeless people in order to start a relationship that will help them figure out what that person's needs are to get them off the street. Service providers do gather this information anyway in order to help their clients, but the new reporting requirements from the city means that they'll have to pass that information on to the city every day. And it's not clear that the city needs that kind of information on a case-by-case basis. You know, there's a big difference between asking service providers, how many people did you serve this week or this month who had a mental health diagnosis, versus asking them, okay, in that encampment that you went to today, which people had a mental health diagnosis? And then what was the outcome? Were you able to help them today? You know, not only is that more invasive, because then there's no hiding who does and doesn't have a mental health diagnosis, there's also, it's also much more onerous for these service providers to have to provide that information every single day rather than gather it together and provide it on, say, a weekly or a monthly basis.
And I should point out also that over the past several years, this has been an ongoing point of contention between the city and service providers, is city requirements for data collection that's highly invasive, and the terms of the contracts. You know, the city has been requiring, you know, basically performance-based metrics in order to award and renew contracts with service providers, and those metrics just are not realistic. This has been an ongoing problem with the Durkin administration, and it really points up the critical need for new leadership at City Hall, which we will get this year. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, and there's also this issue of making it look as if the problem is at the service provider level, not at the root cause, which is that the city doesn't have enough affordable housing for people who struggle with things like mental health issues, or who have substance abuse issues, or who are, you know, didn't complete high school and can't get more than a minimum wage job. You know, the real root cause is that the city lacks enough low-income housing. But when the city focuses all its efforts on requiring service providers to meet certain metrics by now giving daily reports to the city on these are the number of people we contacted, these are their issues, here's what we did, you know, it really, in essence, tries to make it look like the blame is that service providers are not doing enough.
Which, as opposed to, say, you know, the city failing for the last 30 years to plan for affordable housing.
Exactly. Or fund affordable housing and or require developers to include it in their developments along with market rate housing. Now, also the city and the new navigation team, which is now called the HOPE team, and don't be mistaken that it has changed much, because it hasn't, are back to sweeping visible tent encampments at the beck and call of businesses and wealthy homeowners. This is in spite of a CDC advisory recommending that cities not remove tent encampments during the pandemic and to not force people to go into group shelters, because it can spread COVID-19. The city of Seattle is rushing to get back to the bad old status quo of let's just sweep homeless people around the city, let's just push them into congregate shelters, you know, as if the pandemic never happened. But it's late May, and Seattle businesses, of course, are hoping for a tourist season this summer, particularly downtown business community, because, you know, we didn't have one last year, and a whole lot of businesses downtown really had a terrible year in 2020, and they want to see that turnaround, and they want to see it in time for tourists to come to Seattle and spend their money. So as part of that push, the mayor's office and the new HOPE team, which is the old navigation team, it appears, are ramping up the sweeps.
And whose Orwellian idea was it to call it a HOPE team? I mean, seriously.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I hope I can spend a night in jail, you know?
Yeah, I hope you'll come along and take all my belongings and, you know. Force me out of my temporary shelter.
Yeah. I hope you'll endanger my safety over and over again.
Yeah. I hope you'll create chaos, more chaos in my life.
Mm-hmm. We could go on.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think Mike would like that.
Well, it does, as Maria pointed out, I mean, one of these changes there, rationing down on the service providers, whether that was part of the plan or not, it sure seems like that's a great way of completely distancing the service providers from the very people that they're trying to serve and basically neuter the one thing that is working in this current system.
Yeah, it's like geared to drive a wedge between homeless people and the service providers who are trying to establish some kind of system, some kind of a way for them to kind of throw them a life preserver to help them pull them out of the cycle that they're in. You know, you really sometimes just need someone to come along and say, hey, I can help you out. You know, just let me know what it is. What's the one or two things you really need to help get you back on your feet? You know, and help you get stable.
God knows the city isn't doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes that involves some really personal stuff that a person wouldn't tell somebody they don't trust, like their immigration status or their medical diagnosis. You know, maybe they have some really, really high costs in terms of dealing with a disability, and it means they can't pay rent. You know, they have to put all their money towards medication that they need. Or maybe they need a wheelchair. They need a new wheelchair, you know, or maybe they need some way to reestablish their identity, because in the chaos of their life, they lost their driver's license. They lost if they had a passport, they lost that, you know,
or it was thrown away by a navigation team.
Yeah. And they need someone to help them reestablish their identity so that they can go and get a job again. You know, or they were pushed out of their old residence and they didn't have enough savings for a deposit and first and last month's rent to get a new apartment. So they're sleeping in their car. I mean, those are the kinds of things that service providers can really help with, but those are not things that people will just tell anybody who walks up to them, you know, with a clipboard saying, hey, you know, I'm here to offer help, you know, do you this? Do you that? Who, you know, have you this? Have you that? You know, they're like, who the heck are you? Right? No, it takes multiple visits and a lot of time for service providers in order to establish a presence and a connection of trust with people in tent encampments or who are sleeping on the street, you know, that trust is not there automatically just because you're wearing a colored vest that says City of Seattle on it.
Actually, that reduces trust quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
All right. Well, let's move on. Talk about the Washington Black Lives Matter Alliance, John.
Yeah. They have filed a civil complaint with the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Justice, and also met with the FBI asking for investigation of Ed Troyer, who remains the sheriff of Pierce County despite a racist incident last January where he called 911 and said that a black man was threatening to kill him after he had observed the man moving from house to house, casing the houses. Turns out the man was a newspaper carrier, and he was delivering his newspapers on his regular route, and he had become alarmed because he had noticed this unmarked car trailing him for several blocks. Troyer, when questioned by Pierce County deputies, admitted that he made up the bit about the guy threatening to kill him. There was no threat. And so this apparently is still under investigation, yeah, even though Troyer admitted to detectives what actually happened. But that investigation seemingly has gone nowhere, and Troyer remains in his job. And so the FBI and the Department of Justice have now been asked to look into this situation, and it does raise the question of why exactly Pierce County is continuing to employ this man. But we will keep an eye on that because, you know, the wheels of justice grind slowly, but they have been invoked in this case.
All right. Well, yesterday marked the final filing day, I believe, for City of Seattle.
That is correct. We now know who will be on the ballot on August 3rd for the primary.
Yeah.
Mayor and two council positions and city attorney.
Yeah. Now, lots of people announce that they will run, but not all of them actually file the paperwork and pay the fee. So I just hopped in to the King County Elections website and the City of Seattle website to double check on that to see who's actually moving forward with their candidacies.
Yes, we had 20 people announcing as of last week, and we have 50 for mayor, and we have 15 people that actually filed.
So five people did not file, one of whom, Kate Martin, had filed for two different, announced for two different positions and decided to go for council rather than mayor. But yeah, so we're down to 15 for mayor.
Mm-hmm. And among those 15 candidates that filed, six of them are considered really serious candidates who have raised more than $100,000 each. And that those six are Colleen Echo-Hawk, alphabetically, Colleen Echo-Hawk, Jessen Farrell, Lorena Gonzalez, Bruce Harrell, Andrew Grant Houston, and Casey Sixkiller, current deputy mayor, who just jumped into the race about a week and a half ago.
Yeah, he has not actually reported any donations yet, so we'll see how he does on that.
So we'll see how he does. I want to back up a little bit and talk about the King County races, because I could see who had declared in those. Dow Constantine and Joe Nguyen are running for King County Executive. There are also a couple of others in that race, Bill Hurt and Jonathan Crines, not anyone that we've heard of. But
Actually, Bill Hurt is a perennial candidate who is campaigning against an extension of light rail to the east side. That's his big deal.
That's his issue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, of course, Good Space Guy is also in that race. And then for King County Council, most of the incumbents are running for re-election, including Rod Dembrowski in District 1, Kathy Lambert in District 3, Dave Up the Grove in District 5, Pete Von Reichbauer in District 7, and Reagan Dunn in District 9. And the two most conservative on that list, Reichbauer and Dunn, each have three opponents versus one or two for the other candidates. So we'll be looking a little more closely at those races as in the coming weeks.
And that also means they'll be on the primary ballot.
Yeah. For Port of Seattle, three incumbents are running for re-election. Ryan Calkins in position one, Stephanie Bowman in position three, and Peter Steinbrook in position four. Each has drawn one opponent, and notably all three opponents for those three candidates are people of color. So those are going to be very interesting Port of Seattle races. Now, for Seattle City Attorney, incumbent Pete Holmes has finally drawn opponents. He has two opponents. Ann Davison, who formerly ran as Ann Davison Sattler, is a perennial Republican candidate who's run for both the Seattle City Council in District 5 against Deborah Juarez and Lieutenant Governor of Washington, where
This is her third race in 3 years. She ran as a Democrat for city council. Then last year she ran as a Republican for lieutenant governor. And now she's running as nonpartisan. So go figure.
Yeah, so who knows. Now, the other opponent in that race is a King County public defender, Nicole Thomas Kennedy. So it'll be interesting to see what she comes out with in her campaign materials. I don't know very much about her yet. And we'll find out if she's going to be running a really active race against Pete Holmes or not.
Yes, now, and there was another candidate, Steve Fontenoy, who had announced last month but did not file. He was a Microsoft lawyer who was running an anti-homeless platform, and he did not file, so he won't be on the ballot. But Sattler ran for city council 2 years ago, reeling against homelessness, so I expect that will be your main critique of Holmes as well.
Yeah. Now, in City Council District 8, Teresa Mosqueda has, after not having any viable challengers for weeks, at the last minute she has drawn 10 opponents. 10 opponents, none of whom appear to be really serious candidates. And that includes Kate Martin, who gave up her filing for to run for mayor in order to run against Teresa Mosqueda in Seattle City Council District 8. Now, in District 9, there are seven candidates vying for Lorena Gonzalez's seat. The top two are still Nikita Oliver and Sarah Nelson. The others are trailing far behind those two. And it also appears
it's very odd that there's more candidates running, for the seat that is currently being occupied by Mosqueda than are running for the open seat that Gonzalez has abandoned to run for mayor.
But I think it really shows you that when you have two big candidates, one heavily backed by the business, by local businesses, and that would be Sarah Nelson, and one who's very progressive like Nikita Oliver, that that discourages other folks from just jumping into the race. Whereas in Mosqueda's case, she doesn't have a business challenger, so everybody just kind of has.
Yeah, so people were thinking, hey, I could get through to the general election and have three more months of glory.
Yeah, I guess. And of course, there are some fresh faces running for Seattle School Board. So we'll be looking at those in the weeks ahead, too, to see who's running for that thankless job. Now,
glutton for punishment.
Yes.
Masochist. Pick your adjective.
Yes. Now, I wanted to also do an update on fundraising in the Seattle races, the three big Seattle races, the mayor's race and the two city council races as of May 20th, because I haven't looked at that for a couple months. In the mayor's race, Colleen Echohawk is still the leader with $374,787. And a surprise person is in the number two slot now. Andrew Grant Houston has raised $320,727.
I would point out that he seems to be the sole person who's doing a grassroots, small donor-based campaign, as opposed to you've got six or seven people in the race who are trying to get support from the business community, some more successfully than others, Echohawk being the most obvious.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Echohawk is she's also been getting a lot of democracy vouchers. So she appeals to a wide range of people. Now, if you look at I like to do the pie slice test in when it comes to candidates' support from each of the districts. So looking at their donations in the form of a pie chart. And you look at each slice representing each district, where are their donations coming from? If their pie slices are pretty even, then that's a sign that they're a candidate that appeals to a broad section of voters in the city of Seattle. Echohawk has probably the most even slices of anybody in the race right now. So she's, and, each district makes up about 10 to 12% of her donations, and 82% of her contributions are under $200. So she's been one of the stars for collecting democracy vouchers. But at the same time, she's also been appealing to people who are pro-business and also to people who would support a person of color in the mayor's office. So she has a lot of broad appeal. Right now, what I haven't seen yet is a really good candidates forum to see how she stacks up against the other folks in the race in terms of her knowledge of the issues and her ability to speak in public.
Yeah, we've had a couple of like housing homelessness forums so far, but those forums are going to start coming thick and fast, along with endorsements in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
And I don't think a virtual forum really does it quite like having all of the candidates sitting at a table in the same room. We'll see if we see any of those kinds of forums this summer. I would really like to see how she does in that kind of a forum. Andrew Grant Houston is, as Job said, is the candidate who is coming from a more progressive grassroots perspective. He has almost 50% of his contributions from only two districts, though. And that's districts number two and number three. Number two is in southeast Seattle and south and southeast Seattle. And number three is the International District in Capitol Hill. He has really excelled in bringing in the democracy vouchers. But then you have to ask, do those democracy vouchers equal votes? And does he have broad appeal over the rest of over the entire city? And that is really the question. But notably, of the candidates in the race, he has the highest percentage of donations under $200. About 92% of his donations are under $200, and most are likely around $100 or lower in the form of democracy vouchers. Number three in the race is Lorena Gonzalez, who's brought in $245,264. And her pie slices in the pie chart test are looking more even than they did 2 months ago. And that's actually really good news for her. Almost 70% of her donations now are under $200, whereas before she had more big money contributions.
Yeah, downtown law firm money. Basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As of Wednesday, she now has the King County Labor Council, the MLK Labor Council behind her, because she won their endorsement during Wednesday's Labor Council forum. So you can look online if you want to watch that. Now, trailing the pack are candidates Bruce Harrell and Justin Farrell. Bruce Harrell, whose district pie slices are dwarfed by his 34% contributions from folks living outside the city of Seattle. And the vast majority of his contributions, about 45% of them, are at the maximum amount of over $500. And 77% of his total contributions are over $200. So he very clearly is going for the big money, wealthy folks, tech folks.
And that's never a good sign this early in the race, because it means that those folks are maxed out and can't give again. Yeah. Whereas the small donors can give over and over again. And that's been one of the secrets, for example, to Shama Sawant's success over the years, being able to, you know, surge late in races, is that she has a donor base that could still afford to give her money late in the race.
Very large in terms of the number of people.
Yeah.
And also trailing is Justin Farrell, whose pie slices are more even than Bruce Harrell's, except for districts 1 and 2, where apparently no one seems to know her at all. So, again, she's kind of the flip side of someone like Andrew Grant Houston, well known among South Seattle residents and people of color, and Justin Farrell, who appears to be well known among white people.
Yeah, well, you know? she was a state rep from Northeast Seattle for several years and made a reputation that way. She's been out of office, however, for I think 4 years now. Mm-hmm. And and she had a previous unsuccessful bid for mayor 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So we'll see whether she gets any more traction this year.
Yeah.
She does have $103,000 so far, though.
Yeah, that's true. She does have some money. So we can't dismiss her quite yet. And of course, also on the list is Casey Sixkiller, who has yet to turn in a report. His first report on his fundraising. So we'll see in the coming weeks how he does. I think he jumped into the race too late, but I think he's kind of the desperation candidate for the more conservative pro-Durkin contingent at City Hall.
Yeah, and another person who just jumped in last week, Art Langley, grandson of a former mayor and governor. He's raised $7,000 in his first week, so that's very early, but again, he jumped in so late that it's hard to see him getting any traction.
Yeah. Now, in the two city council races, city council position 9 has a surprise in it. Nikita Oliver is now in the lead for her fundraising. She has $185,692, to Sarah Nelson's $120,000. Brianna Thomas, who is Lorena Gonzalez's legislative aide, is trailing the two of them by quite a bit. She only has about $68,000.
None of the other candidates have significant money at all.
Have any money at all, really. And then in council position 9, perennial candidate Kate Martin withdrew from the mayor's race to concentrate on running against Teresa Mosqueda. Of the no-name candidates in that race, Martin has the most funding, but it's only $4,891 versus Teresa Mosqueda's $141,500. So that's the financial wrap-up. For the three big city of Seattle races.
I also want to talk about the couple ballot initiatives that are trying to get signatures right now. The Compassion Seattle Charter Amendment has raised $600,000, mostly from the business community. And then the the effort to recall Shama Sawant, that race has over $1 million poured into it so far. $479,000 for the recall campaign. And then Sawant has raised $531,000 so far. So that is going to have millions and millions of dollars in the race if that actually goes to the ballot. It's going to be very interesting to see where all that money comes from on the recall side. So far, it has come primarily from conservative elements in North Capitol Hill, which is the north and the area toward Lake Washington, the more conservative part of Sawant's district, and then downtown businesses. So we'll see where that money comes from as time goes on, and in both cases, how successful the signature gathering will be. Neither of those is likely to appear in the ballot this year. It would be in a special election early next year if either one goes to the ballot.
Yeah, which means that a very small number of voters will be deciding whether or not to recall Sawant. Typically, in a special election, you have much, much lower voter turnout.
And that is intentional on behalf of the recall mm-hmm. organizers, that they want a special election because they figure that their people are more motivated. Of course, so once people are pretty motivated too, so that kind of cuts both ways, doesn't it?
I wouldn't assume that. Really wouldn't assume that.
I wouldn't either. You would think that folks who have observed so once career would have learned that lesson by now.
You would think. Okay. So, and then I wanted to take one last look at the democracy vouchers because they really are making a big difference in the races so far. Among the candidates, the top six candidates to collect democracy vouchers, Colleen Echohawk and Andrew Grant Houston are the two outstanding candidates on those terms. Colleen Echohawk, 83% of her contributions are from democracy vouchers. For Andrew Grant Houston, it's 85%. Of his contributions. And Lorena Gonzalez is not that far behind with 71% of her contributions. And then Teresa Mosqueda also has about 75% of her contributions are democracy vouchers. And then the other two candidates who have about half of their donations from democracy vouchers are Nikita Oliver and Bruce Harrell. So that's, so if you want to know what rich people do with their democracy vouchers, they give them to Bruce Harrell. and for the other candidates, you can see the number one and number two fundraisers in the mayor's, or actually the top three in the mayor's race there are exactly the top three folks who have collected democracy vouchers. So that really,
and the leading candidates in each of the council races too.
Yes, exactly. And that really shows you that the democracy vouchers do make a big difference on who has the ability to run.
All right. So it sounds like it's going to be an exciting electoral season this
year. Yeah, it's going to be.
We're going to be spending a fair amount of time on that over the next 3 months, I think.
Yeah.
2.5 months, excuse me.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about this week's developments with the pandemic.
Yeah, well, I feel like I called this one because Seattle King County Public Health agreed with me this week. Do you want to talk about that, Maria? You had that on your list.
Sure. You know, it's kind of amazing to me. Our mayor, Jenny Durkin, is continuing to oversee sweeps of homeless encampments. And our governor, Jay Inslee, from the top, has decided not to roll back Washington's reopening in spite of a resurgence of COVID-19 cases. In between those two is our King County Health Officer, Jeff Duchenne, who was left to remind people in King County this week that you guys, we're about half vaccinated, not close to herd immunity. So people have to continue to wear a mask when you're indoors in a public place.
And not only
reminding businesses that, yeah, you can't take down those mask required signs yet.
Yeah. Although a number of large businesses have, and that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind, you have two major
parts of the population that are not protected, other than quote unquote unvaccinated people. One of them, of course, is kids under the age of 12 and really under the age of 15, because people 12 to 15 have only been eligible for the vaccine for a week. So most of those folks are not vaccinated yet, and have not had a chance to be. And then you have immunocompromised people, of which there are millions in the United States. And that's gotten very little discussion. Those are folks who may be fully vaccinated, but the vaccines don't necessarily work. The preliminary data shows that about 1 in 6 people get protection off of the vaccines. Who have been, for instance, transplant patients, people who have gone through chemo, et cetera, et cetera. There are any number of conditions that leave one as immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. And, you know, you don't know who those people are, right, when you're out in the community. So if you want to protect them and you want to protect yourself, and you don't want to put frontline service providers in an awkward position, you know, service workers and whatnot, just wear a mask indoors. Just do it. It's not hard. It protects you. It protects the community. And we're not, any, as Ray Maria said, we're not anywhere near herd immunity yet.
I just want to remind people that if you got a 2-dose regimen of one of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, they're 94% effective, which means that there's still some folks who will get COVID-19 after being vaccinated. And you probably won't get super sick, the kind of sick that makes you stay home and stay in bed. So you might, if you're out there not wearing a mask and you might be feeling like, oh, maybe my allergies are acting up, you could have COVID and you could be spreading it. Okay. And so that's why you need to wear a mask even if you've been vaccinated. If you got the Johnson & Johnson shot, that shot is about 70 to maybe up to 80% effective. So your chances are greater of maybe having a mild case of COVID and spreading it. So that's why you need to be wearing a mask until everyone has a shot, has the chance to get vaccinated to get enough protection so that if they get COVID-19, they won't get desperately, terribly ill and need to go to the hospital. That's why you wear a mask.
Even after you've been fully vaccinated, it takes a couple additional weeks for the vaccine to take effect.
Yes.
So there's that too.
And also, you know, I got my second shot this week and I asked the nurse who gave me the shot. I said, are people coming in for their second doses? And he said that where he worked, that yes, he was seeing a lot of people coming back in, but that he had heard that up to 1 million people in Washington State have not come in for their second shot. And they really need to, because if you don't go for your second shot of the 2-dose regimen, you're almost negating the effects of the first shot. It doesn't on its own provide enough protection. It doesn't stimulate your immune system.
It's about 50 to 60% effective as opposed to,
like a point.
94%. So it's much more of a crapshoot, honestly.
Yeah.
And you're much more likely to get a serious case as well. And you're much more, you can much more easily spread it.
Yes.
If you've only had the one shot. So
yeah, and
for all of those reasons.
That you practically negate the point. You practically negate the reason for getting vaccinated if you're not getting the full regimen, because you're much more likely to be out there with a mild illness spreading the virus. So the whole point is to go through the complete course. I've done it myself. I'm the kind of person who always gets a reaction to something like this. And I did get sick from my first dose of the vaccine, but not so much from the second dose, which the nurse told me is what they saw in healthcare workers who had actually had COVID infections. So I was probably had an asymptomatic infection. And how would I know, right? How would you know if you had an asymptomatic infection? Any person, any one of us who didn't get super sick from COVID-19 or didn't get sick at all in the last year and a half could have had it and not known it. So,
Or wasn't getting regularly tested.
Yeah, exactly. Or even if you were getting tested, say, you know, once a month or once every other week, you could have had it in the interim and not known it. You know, so it's really super important for everyone to get vaccinated who can get vaccinated, and that you do the full course if you're doing a 2-shot regimen. you know? So there's no, oh, I got one shot, I'm good. Or, oh no, everybody else is getting the vaccine, but so I don't need to. None of that. You know, that's not acceptable. And I want to kind of point out some of the statistics about King County. King County is seeing around 200 new COVID-19 cases per day. So we are nowhere near out of the woods.
Yeah. It's actually dropped below 200 now. It's just more in the 150 range, but, so it's going in the right direction, but it is still quite high.
Yeah, so while vaccinations in King County reached a peak in April, they're down by about one-third in May. Residents living within the metropolitan areas of the county averaged between 65% to over 80% having received at least one dose. But the rural and southern parts of the county are hovering around 50 to 60%. Part of that may be the difficulty in finding the vaccine in remoter areas or getting doses to populations who speak English as a second language or to those who fear questions about their immigration status or to those who must work 7 days a week in order to make a living. It can be really hard to take time off to get a shot when you're working 7 days a week to try to make rent and food for a family. I think it's really important in those cases for folks to have the vaccine available to them at their neighborhood pharmacy or to be able to get it at work. You know,
an employer who's willing to give you a couple days sick days off if you have a reaction to the vaccine, which, you know, there's way too many people who are afraid to take days off of work for they're sick or whatever reason because they'll get fired.
Exactly.
And that's a serious problem in this country.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then outside of King County in the state of Washington, the numbers are actually much worse than that. In all of Washington state, only 42.3% of the state's population is fully vaccinated and 53.5% have received at least one dose. Those numbers are not good enough for the reopening that businesses and that the governor are looking at. King County is actually
although those are both above the national, those are both above the national average, and nationally we've seen, you know, states rushing to embrace the CDC guidance and reopen, which I think is just a huge mistake.
Yeah, so just want to remind folks we're nowhere near herd immunity, which optimistically is above 70% fully vaccinated, when actually what we see with other highly transmissible diseases, you need above 90% of your population fully vaccinated in order to stop.
Although in localities where we have above 70%, we are starting to see sharp decreases in the number of cases. And the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations, and now also the number of deaths, which is a lagging indicator, have all been going down nationally quite sharply. So this is good. This is the right direction, but we're not there yet. So it's not time to relax quite yet.
Yeah, we're not there yet. As Job said, vaccination rates across the nation, we're seeing something like 38.5% fully vaccinated. So just a little over a third of the population, and 48.6% have received one dose. So not even quite 50% of Americans having received one dose of the vaccine. That's just not good enough quite yet for the kind of reopening that people are desperate to see.
Are planning for.
Yeah.
At least if they follow our governor's lead.
Yes.
All right. So before we leave the subject, globally, is things looking as dire as they did last week?
Pretty much. Yep. We are the piece of good news that we're seeing is we've had several studies come out this week that looks like our current vaccines are also effective against the highly contagious Indian variant, which is now sweeping through Southeast Asia the same way that it has been sweeping through India. And the horror stories coming out of India just continue. They're relentless. Very, very grim stories that we don't have time to go into here. But, most Southeast Asian countries are in lockdown now. These are countries that, had a lot of success combating, the pandemic, for the first year or so. But, they have, had a number of outbreaks in different, major cities throughout Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, et cetera, are all in lockdown now. And they are all combating the Indian variant that is dominant there. The Indian variant has also become dominant in the UK, has not really hit yet in the US, and that, again, is another reason to be concerned about the reopening that's premature in the United States. And Brazil and Latin America continue to be in trouble as well. So that's the global update.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to other national news. Police shootings this week?
Yeah. Well, there weren't any shootings per se this week. I mean, not that made, you know, major news anyway, but there were a couple of important developments in previous cases. The Elizabeth City, North Carolina case, the killing of Andrew Brown, the DA in Pasquotank County, North Carolina, announced that there would be no charges against any of the police, that their shooting of Andrew Brown was justified, and they released the body cam footage of the shooting from the perspective of the six or so sheriff's deputies that participated. And it shows Brown basically trying to evade officers and drive away, and several officers literally opening fire at the car as it was driving away. One of those shots hit Brown in the back of the head and killed him. How you could conclude that this was a justified use of force is beyond me, but that was what the DA in rural Pasquotank County, North Carolina, concluded. There is a federal investigation into Brown's killing that has been opened as well. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. The Department
we'll
of Justice
uncovers any corruption in that DA's office.
Well, again, especially in a rural county like that, the sheriff's office and the DA's office tend to work very closely together. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of calls for the DA to recuse himself, which he refused to do.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, speaking of corruption and rural cops, highway patrolmen in Louisiana, outside Monroe, Louisiana. This is a killing from 2019 where the body cam footage was leaked this week to the AP. The state had been burying it for over 2 years, saying that this was an ongoing investigation. This was a guy named Ronald Green. He led officers on a high-speed chase, African-American guy, in 2019 in northeast Louisiana, rural northeast Louisiana on I-20. And basically the officers came there, started tasing him while he was still in his car, and then just kept tasing him and beating him until he died.
Yeah, I saw some of the clips of the leaked video, and it was really deeply disturbing.
Very, very disturbing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple obvious questions here. Number one, why have there been no charges? Number two, why was the state trying to bury this footage for over 2 years? Of course, we probably know the answer to the second question, and it has a lot to do with the answer to the first question also. But I would expect that there will be there are already calls for the Department of Justice under the Biden administration to get involved in that one as well. Bear in mind that DOJ under the Biden administration in its first 4 months has been complete reversal. Of course, they've got a lot of damage to clean up from the previous guy. And one of the things that they're back in business doing is looking at local law enforcement agencies. They've already announced investigations into the Minneapolis Police Department and the Louisville Metropolitan Metro Police Department. And they've looked at some of these shootings, or they're starting to look at some of these shootings. And, you know, so hopefully we will start to see some consent decrees and some federal oversight to some of these troubled departments and some of these federal charges on some of these very, very disturbing law enforcement killings.
Mm-hmm. And in police agencies outside of the big metropolitan areas. So looking at some of these county agencies and some of these rural agencies would be very welcome, I think.
Yeah, and again, that is why You know, there were calls this week for the DOJ to look at Pierce County, and Ed Troyer and, his record of racism on the job. So I think we'll be hearing a lot more from the Biden administration on that front over the next year or so.
Okay. Moving on to, Arizona. Audit.
Yeah, let's talk about Georgia first. Speaking of law enforcement, you may remember a story from late last year where there was an ICE facility in rural southern Georgia, a place called Irwin County, where a gynecologist there was performing forced hysterectomies on detainees, immigrant women who had been detained by ICE. And this was a big story for about 30 seconds in national media before it got subsumed by other Trump administration scandals. And it turned out that there were a number of other abuses going on at that ICE facility as well. HHS and announced this week that that facility is going to be closed, and this is something that advocates had been asking for several months. So that's a piece of good news. And also there is a criminal investigation underway against that gynecologist. It turned out, once that story became news that, that literally dozens of women came forward and said, yes, he performed a hysterectomy on me. He said it was necessary. He wouldn't explain why. I have no idea why it happened. Once those women started signing, complaints, and talking to investigators, the Trump administration started immediately deporting them. So that's another piece of the scandal also, because a lot of those women now are back in their home countries because the Trump administration apparently wanted to bury the story. So it makes you wonder how far up the food chain that particular initiative went and whether it happened in other ICE facilities as well, and we just haven't heard about it yet. But that was a piece of good news, that that particular ICE facility is going to be shut down. One down, many to go. Yeah. But, yeah, there's just not much you can say about that. That's just horrific.
Pretty horrific, yeah.
So you mentioned Arizona, Mike. Clown car, big lie, conspiracy theory, audit, quote unquote, of the 2020 presidential election in Maricopa County, Arizona, which is the county that Phoenix is in. It's one of the population, one of the largest counties in the country, continues, apace. They took a week break because they had to use the space that they were using for the recount to have high school graduations instead, because of course Arizona is fully open. Yeah, so they went from people who can count to people who can't count. So there have been a number of developments this week in that particular story. For one thing, we had several members of the Republican Board of Supervisors from Maricopa County beg the state Republicans in the state Senate, this is who ordered the recount, to call it off because it was an embarrassment. The company that they subcontracted to, a company called Cyber Ninjas, if you can believe that. Their CEO is a good buddy of Lynn Wood, who spent the immediate aftermath of the election living in Lynn Wood's basement, trying to prove that there was election fraud in Georgia. So this is now the guy who's running the recount in Arizona. This tells you how legitimate it actually is. No experience in recounts, no experience in election laws. And so it turns out this week that the Arizona Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, who is also a Republican, had to inform Maricopa County that because there was no chain of custody for either the ballots or the voting machines, that her office could not guarantee that the voting machines had not been tampered with, and therefore Maricopa County would have to buy hundreds and hundreds of new ballot counting voting machines and ballot counting machines, because all of those had the chain of custody had been violated by the state Senate in handing this over to this private contractor, who was, basically run by a guy who is, a big QAnon guy. I want to talk a little bit.
Yeah, I wouldn't want those machines back either.
No. Well, no, they can't by federal law. They
no.
Can't.
Absolutely
but,
not.
But beyond that, I want to talk about the purposes. The purpose of this is not to overturn the election. I mean, that's the stated goal, right? We want to keep looking for results until we find the result that we want. But the real purpose of this, number one, is to undermine confidence in elections, particularly among people who are, not to put too fine a point on it, credulous morons. Who believe Trump, believe the big lie. Trump, of course, has continued to insist that he was the rightful winner of the 2020 election. And, you know, some 40% of Republicans believe him, which is terrifying because, there have been, scores of different, lawsuits that have all failed in court, for lack of evidence to prove any of this. There has been no credible evidence to that effect. Bill Barr's Department of Justice found that there was no credible evidence of election fraud. And he just goes on and on and on, but the evidence doesn't matter. This is a religious cult. And it is a deeply authoritarian cult that is actively trying to undermine democracy right now. The other thing that we're starting to see this week, yesterday there was a court ruling in Georgia that a very similar attempt to recount ballots there, which have already been audited 3 times in Fulton County, Georgia, which is the state's largest county, which is where Atlanta is, which of course is heavily African American and heavily Democratic. And so the ballots there have to be counted by some outside contractor to be named by state Republicans as well. This is a state, mind you, that already reserved to itself the right to overturn election results that it didn't like. Going forward. So, we're seeing,
and this comes on the heels of all of these Southern Republican states passing very restrictive voter laws in recent months too.
It's not just Southern states. Iowa has passed laws like that. Montana has passed laws like that. It's any place that's controlled by Republicans, basically. It's in process or it has already passed. Arizona has already passed it. Florida and Georgia, of course, have already passed it. Texas has been on the verge of passing it for some time.
Texas has passed some very far right wing laws.
Yeah,
in reaction, I think, to the Texas Republican Party being challenged more by a resurgent Democratic Party in Texas.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a minute, too. Mm-hmm.
We really only have a minute left.
Need to probably wrap up.
Let's go ahead and go to that then. Texas passed the most insane anti-abortion law in the country's history. Maybe not the history, but certainly since Roe v. Wade. Recent history. The past 50 years of judicial precedent, the blatantly unconstitutional law that requires that bans abortion after 6 weeks of impregnation.
Which now, essentially bans all abortions because as a woman, you can't really know you're pregnant and you don't really know you're pregnant until you've missed a couple periods.
Yes. So for all intents and purposes, it bans abortion. and it anticipates the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, which the Supreme Court is going to consider that. We'll get a ruling next year. Just in time for the midterms, probably.
It's part of a Republican push to try to get laws before a newly conservative U.S. Supreme Court that would eventually ban abortions. The U.S. Supreme Court has said it will take up the Mississippi and hear the Mississippi law later this year, probably in the fall. That law bans abortions after 15 weeks, but this Texas law literally would ban all abortions. And it just shows you how very extreme the Republican Party in Texas has become.
Yeah, it used to be that Republicans were anti-abortion except in cases of rape and incest. that's out the window now, particularly since rape and incest seem to be a cottage industry among Republicans. But that's another topic for another week.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time.
Okay.
That's an uplifting note to end on.
Yes, and we will see y'all next week.
Sounds good.